Hello, everyone. This is Grandmaster Jesse Bowen, and welcome to our show today, the AMA Martial Arts Masters, along with the Sport Karate Museum and Professor Gary Lee. We're reaching across the country, around the world, seeking out martial artists that can help us to be able to look at our past and improve our future. And today we have on the call a legend in the martial arts, a pioneer in the martial arts on all levels, you know, as a teacher, as a trainer, as a coach, as an author. He has so many amazing things that he's done in his past, and so we're calling upon him today to share that past with us and give us some directions and just sort of enjoy a journey, and that is with, you know, Grandmaster George Dillman. Hello, sir. How are you doing today?
Doing fine.
Well, thank you for taking your time and, you know, being on our call. We want to, you know, just sort of chat with you today, and, you know, you're featured in our book, Who's Who in the Martial Arts, and again, thank you for allowing us to print your bio and share your information and this very powerful story that you have. And so today, let's talk about you. This is really all about you, and the book was really about sharing.
The book, Who's Who, is very impressive. I just wanted to get that in. It's very well put together and bound, and it's well worth the money, I'll tell you that.
Well, sir, thank you. I really appreciate it, and, you know, my teacher actually did the book. He and his partner back in the early 80s, that was Dale Brooks and Jan Wellendorf. And, you know, we did this book, and we've shared it before back last year, 2015. And as Mr. Brooks passed away, I wanted to come back and do something to honor Mr. Brooks and Sensei Wellendorf. And that was my motivation for doing the book. This year, you know, we reached out, and we touched the lives of a lot of martial artists, and we awakened something that's a movement now. We've now doing the Martial Arts History Month, and just trying to find out and share that story that someone may have that may motivate someone to decide to become a martial artist. Who knows, might decide to become a business owner, and they may just decide to become a grandmaster in the martial arts once they hear an inspiring story. So tell us a little bit about you, sir. What motivated you to get involved in the martial arts?
I actually have been in the martial arts my entire life, and I started at the age of 9, which I didn't know this would lead to a whole life thing, but I was in a judo class at a YMCA in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and I was in there about a year and a half, and the instructor closed the class and moved away. Moved from the middle of Pennsylvania, or this end, the east end, over to the west end, and we lost the school, and everybody felt at a loss, but nothing you can do about it, and I just had that yearn to be back in a gi, a uniform. And when I had the opportunity, my stepfather trained people during World War II in self-defense for the Army. He was spent 35 years in the U.S. Army. And anyway, to make a long story short, he taught me how to kick. They taught us how to kick a little bit in that judo class, but he taught me how to kick properly, how to kick, hit him, and get that knee back and ready to go, and hit him with a hand. And he trained me in some basic fighting techniques because he wanted me to know self-defense. I was a young kid going to go to the movie theater by myself or go here, and he wanted me to be able to handle myself. At age 14, I had such a like for that. I went down to the YMCA where I had the judo, and I wound up trying out for the boxing team. And I made the boxing team. There's pictures of that in my book. And I was the youngest one on the team, but I did a pretty good job handling myself with my fists. In fact, got so good, I turned, I wouldn't say pro, they were, those boxing matches at the time were called smokers. They were usually above a firehouse or a clubhouse, and everybody sat around smoking. You didn't realize what it was about, but you were in there beating each other's brains out for their enjoyment. So I did that for actually 3.5 years and was going through high school. And I went in the military. And when I got in the military, there was a, they taught also how to kick, and you got, not long, but you got 21 hours of combat, and combat with a rifle and combat with a bayonet. And then we were going on and on and on, and I got to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and one of the men there at the recruiting station said to me, talked to me, and he put down that he does karate. And I said, oh, where's that at? What's it about? And he told me. And I said, boy, I said, I used to box. And I said, I'm really a pretty good boxer. At least I did good there. In basic training, we had some boxing matches between the barracks. And I had won those. But he said, no, this is way different than boxing. Karate's better than boxing. Karate people can beat boxers up. And my ears lit up. I said, oh, really? I said, I'm pretty good. He said, well, stand up and try to hit me. And so I got up and proceeded with a left jab or something, and he sidekicked me. And then his foot was all over my waist area, and he didn't kick me in the groin, but he shot a kick there, and I thought, oh, boy. I said, where are these classes at? He said, the Brown Arena up here at the gym. And he said, they're every Tuesday and Thursday night, he told me, and that happened to be a Tuesday. I went that night to class, kind of watched, but they got me off and showed me a few things. And then from then on, it was history. And in the military, I met a man named Harry G. Smith, who just came back from Okinawa. Very rough, tough individual. In fact, he's hanging in. He's pushing 80, but he's still, I wouldn't say he has a dojo anymore. I think he closed it. But he still actually practices, and he's good, tough, ex-military man who actually used his stuff in combat. So I started training with him, and that was it. I never looked back, just kept going. And when I moved away, was transferred away, I had a thirst for more. In fact, I went to Washington, D.C. from there. And that's when I met Mr. Jun Ri. And Jun Ri, I went down and watched a class, and I wound up joining his school. And because they were really kickers. A lot of people thought they could kick until you got to Jun Ri's school. And then they kicked with lightning speed, and they were really good. And I joined that school, and I got to say, they added kicking to my Okinawan martial arts, which was mainly punching. We did kick, but we didn't kick like the Taekwondo people. So I worked out with that class, and I met a man named Ken Crawford, and he came over to where I was stationed. Well, ironically, he was stationed with the same unit, but he was in the mechanics department. And I was in the military police section. I became a military policeman. I went to officer school. And I could inject there that that's what added a lot to my career was the martial arts. It helped me everywhere I went, anywhere I went. Got the job. I got to move up a rank or two as sergeant because they wanted me to teach the combat in one of the units, wound up getting a promotion, then I was recommended for officer school. I got in officer school because one of the things I had on my form was I'm a black belt, I'm a martial artist. And they saw in that a leader. And off to officer school, and I became an officer in military police, stationed for several years there in Washington, D.C. And I was involved in, I'm a veteran. I was involved with the Vietnam War, but I never went to Vietnam. Military police were kept in Washington, D.C. to handle the riots. When the hippies attacked the Pentagon, I was in the front row, and when the riots happened in the D.C., I was attached to the 82nd Airborne to make sure they knew what to do and where all the trouble areas were in the nation's capital.
You know, that's a very important
point. That's my career.
Point.
I just kept going.
You know, that's a very important point you just made that, you know, because I feel the same way. You know, because of my martial arts, I've been blessed to do so many things because of the specialty, you know, of the martial arts. And that's one of the key elements that, you know, corporate people are looking for. If you want to go out and train or if my kids are going off to college, you know, you got a martial arts background, maybe you achieve your black belt. You know, everyone has a high expectation of you as a martial artist. They're expecting for you to have the discipline. They're expecting for you to have the confidence. They're expecting for you to have the tools and techniques to be able to defend yourself. You know, and that's the reason why in legal situations, you know, it's just so many things that's expected if you hold that black belt. And I think that's a really key point that when we're talking about some of the things that the martial arts can now do for anyone, you know, for the kids, for the adults, for mom, you know, it will change your life. And this is what I tell people all the time. You may be good at what you do. Martial arts really helps you to understand yourself. And for so many times and for so many people, they go through life and they never have a chance to understand themselves or even consider to reach their ability. And martial arts brings out, you know, one of those attributes. Would you not agree?
Oh, I do. If I was to make a list of students that got ahead or got a better job or anything just because they were a martial artist, the list would go on and on and on. My, she's an ex-wife now, but we were married at the time, got her job as a school teacher teaching English. But they picked her because of the black belt thing, because she was in a teaching a class of kids that were troublesome and had already hit another teacher or something. So they put them in her class, and they knew my reputation. They know she was a black belt. And they actually didn't give her much grief where anybody else would have. And then I had other people become everything from prison guards to policemen because they had my, or a black belt, not necessarily mine, any, but they had mine, and they moved ahead in life. I guess you saw on the computer even recently, one of the schools or several of the schools have introduced meditation instead of
mm-hmm.
detention.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
kids have to meditate. Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. And that's one of the things I did at Duke University. I just retired from Duke University after teaching for 28 years, martial arts, mindfulness classes, Aikido classes, judo classes, as a part of physical education. And for the past 8 years, that's one of the classes that I've taught at the university. And I truly believe that this is the way you're going to the inner arts will be the next art that will emerge and now have a dominant place. Right now we've seen mixed martial arts, Krav Maga, you've seen all these other arts sort of come up, but I believe that the next turn that we're going to have is going to be about the inner arts, because people are getting to the point now, they understand that whatever's going on in their lives is really happening on the inside, and before they can make changes, they're going to have to make those changes. And I'm really glad to see that, you know, more people are applying this, and a lot of the universities and medical institutions, they are now understanding the power of our mind, which now controls our body.
Back in the 60s, I studied with a man named Daniel K. Pye. In fact, all the way through the 60s, I don't know if you heard him, but he's a Hawaiian-Chinese person and a first cousin to Ed Parker, who is well known.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Daniel K. Pye became my instructor for the longest time, and he introduced what's being introduced now in Richmond, Virginia, meditation and the martial arts in the gym classes and after school.
Mm-hmm.
And after school, they had to report to him if they had problems. And when they were done his class, they didn't have any problems. I said, do you hit them? Well, how'd you straighten some of those people out? He said, we didn't call it hit them, we called it sparring. They had to spar, you know, karate spar.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were taking karate class, so you could legally hit them upside the head with a glove on.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd understand. So then when he moved out of there and moved on, that came to an end. I guess nobody could run the class like him, but the kids respected him because he was Chinese, Hawaiian, and he looked it. And they just, you know, Bruce Lee and that whole era, if anybody was Chinese, they go, ooh, he knows karate.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's that story, but I studied under Daniel K. Pye. And I went on, I guess you know, to meet Muhammad Ali.
Right.
And I trained him for 3.5 years. I trained with him. I don't want to say I trained him because he had a trainer. But I was a workout partner, and I worked out with him for 3.5 years. Road work, bag work, went to his fights, went to his house. He came to my house. He came to my karate school. His wife trained at my karate school twice a week. And Muhammad Ali and I were very close. And when they had the big award ceremony for him in Philadelphia with the Freedom Medal, I was asked to come down, and they used my pictures. 34 of my pictures were on the big screen, big jumbotron, behind him and out in the streets of Philadelphia. They had big jumbotrons. And I almost fainted when I got there because there's my picture up on a jumbotron. But my pictures were used, and his wife told them, where can we get these pictures? She said, contact George Stillman. I think he has the best photo record of all from that camp. And then I wound up buying that camp and making it a martial arts camp. And we had training there for almost 20 years. I just sold the camp, but it was the only place. I went over to Japan, and they had the Budokan there where everybody trained, and it was like a big training. It was like Muhammad Ali's camp, only in Japan. And I went down to China, and they had the Shaolin Temple, and same thing. It was like Muhammad Ali's camp, only in China. Well, we had one here in the U.S., and I virtually had people come in from all over the world over 20 years to train and teach. Anybody that had anything to teach was offered a spot on the mat, and everything from disarming to knife fighting to standard martial arts, it all went on up there. And I just recently sold that because I'm kind of getting ready for or building into retirement. I'd like to say I am retired, but I have 6 books out and 50 DVDs. And as long as they're out there for sale, looks like I won't ever retire, but
because
I'm constantly being called. Well, like I'm doing the radio show now. I did a TV show a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't count the number of radio shows I've done interviews because they find out you're available, the phone rings.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, because I know if we go back, and I was reading online, I think it was Karate Illustrated, one of the magazines was talking about your greatness in the sport of karate and your competitive skills and all the things that you possess, and one of the winningest competitors in the martial arts during that period. Let's talk a little bit about this sport of karate. And I know that, you know, when you were coming up, it's totally different than it is now. So share that. Share some information with us on that.
Well, early on, and everybody thought it changed. You had to fight somebody, and we didn't have safety punch and safety kick. You wore a groin cup if you were lucky. Some tournaments didn't even want you to wear a groin cup, believe it or not. And but you wore a groin cup, and that was about it. A lot of the tournaments, you weren't allowed to have shin guards. And it made you move. It made you get out of the way of a lot that you would have just stood there and blocked had you had a shin guard on or whatever. But you didn't want a sore shin, so you learned real fast how to move left and how to move right and close in. And I did win 300 and some trophies. All the magazines, it was in covers of magazines I was on, but I won almost every major tournament in the country. I won trophies in something. I always came home with trophies. Not always in fighting. Official Karate Magazine did a big feature story called The Real Champions or something, and they said I was a consistent winner with about 60% of my wins in fighting, but I had 100% wins in weapons and breaking, which I did, and about a 90 to 100% win in kata forms, because I was really a good forms competitor. And that was my career. I expanded, started competing in 1964, 63 actually. I entered a tournament, but I didn't do good, so we don't talk about that. No, I'm just kidding. 64 up. And then I retired from tournament fighting in 1972. The man that heads that owned and started Century Martial Arts actually gave a quote, and he said, "You're the winningest competitor." It actually was one of his quotes. "You're the winningest competitor that I've ever known." He said, "You have your Joe Louis or this guy or that guy, and they consistently win in fighting. But," he said, "you win in all the areas. I mean, you prove you're a steady all-around martial artist. And you go in and compete all day long," which I did. I went in and did forms, and if there was a breaking competition, I did that. If there was a weapons competition, I did that. And a fighting competition, I did that. Fighting was always harder to me than the weapons and the kata, because you do a real good clean kata and you finish in the top three, and then you play off for who gets first. But in fighting, geez, you fight, you win, you got to do it again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, there used to be hundreds of competitors in every division. And tournaments were rough because there was no gloves, no rubber feet, and yet you weren't supposed to draw blood. If you drew blood, you were disqualified, but yet you could hit the guy. I could hit you in the face. It made you really be aware and control of your hands and feet.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing it really did. It really, you knew where your hands and feet were going, and you knew how much power where it was going to go, because you know if you kicked the guy or made him bleed, you're out of there. And many a times there was blood, and the judges, if it was a mild blood, they just pretended they didn't see it. And that went on. It's the same thing as on today, but it went on. And that's what happened.
So,
I fought many of the greats and held my own or won at one point or another.
You know, I always try to share with students the importance, you know, because I came up in the sport karate, you know, different era paths had just come in. We were doing something totally different. But I still connect that experience as a part of the motivation for me to continue in the martial arts because, you know, the sport of karate, what it gave you was that sense of having to go out, and one of the closest levels or experience to real combat and to the sense that you're not, you know, really trying to hurt someone. You're trying to use the control, your skills.
Yep.
There's a set of rules. There's a set of guidelines that you're going by. But you had to go out and face someone that was not your classmate. So that gave you a sense of confidence. And
that's what I told
my why I said for students today is sport karate is still an important value for you to get out and have that experience of having to compete against someone you don't know. And most times in a mugging or attacking situation, it's probably not going to be someone that you know. And
no, exactly.
You have to have that confidence to be able to do that.
Yeah. I ran tournaments for 35 years. Some of the greats come out of my tournaments. Cynthia Rothrock, who's on the cover of your book, consistent winner at my tournament. And by the way, a lot of people, they might or might not know, but a lot of people don't know, she was actually a scrapper as a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she won fighting at my tournament with some of the roughest women around this whole area, and Cynthia Rothrock was all over them. And she was a really good competitor, and she almost always would win first place in form and first place in weapons. But she really did good. Billy Blanks come out of my tournaments. I helped Billy Blanks get discovered in a way. He was competing, and I talked to him several times. I said, Billy, you're too good to be just competing in these local tournaments. And I said, you need to get some notice, get to a national tournament. And I talked to him. Then I talked to Leo Fong, and Leo Fong said, send him out here. We'll get him some press. And
Leo Fong's in the book.
Oh, I know. Well, yeah, I know. Leo Fong's a really good friend of mine. I mean, we've been friends. You'll never guess who introduced me to Leo Fong. Bruce Lee.
Bruce Lee. Okay.
Bruce
okay.
Lee. Introduced
that was,
me to Wally J.
My mind.
Professor Wally J. And Leo Fong. Bruce Lee introduced me. And Bruce Lee told Leo Fong, before he met me, he says, you got to meet George Dillman. He's about the best thing on the East Coast I've seen. He said, I'm not saying the country, but he said, George Dillman was really good, and you ought to see him do his weapons. And Bruce not only said that, but then he put it in writing, and I have a copy of that letter from Leo. And that's the story, but not many people can say Bruce Lee introduced him to
somebody.
Mm-hmm. Back then, there wasn't as many schools. Everybody knew everybody. Today, I don't know anybody. There's in my town, there used to be three karate schools, and now there's like 35 in the Yellow Pages.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they ain't even doing Yellow Pages, they're online. But there's 35 schools running around, the next town. Back then, there were a few schools. When somebody had a school in Chicago, you knew it. And usually heard his name, and then you'd say to somebody, hey, so-and-so is... Oh, he's pretty good, or he does this, or he does that. And then you'd want to meet him, and you'd go to a tournament he was at. And that's the way it was. You knew who was in Los Angeles. And people introduced people to people. Ed Parker introduced me to Bruce Lee. Ed Parker brought Bruce Lee to my house. That's all in my book. But Ed Parker brought Bruce Lee in and said, I want you to meet somebody. He said, this young boy is really good, referring to Bruce Lee. And he was way younger at the time. And so we got talking, and they had dinner at my house. And it was one of those magic moments.
Just think about, if we hadn't had those, all the things that, and this is the thing that we're really trying to emphasize and to bring out when we talk about history. If these things and these experiences and people such as yourself had never been around, we would probably have a different story about the martial arts. We may not be governing the martial arts right now. So this is what makes history. Someone started something that started something that started something, and now we talk about karate as a way of life. As you said, before, you look on every corner, there's a martial arts school. It's being introduced to sports now. There's so many areas that martial arts now, because, I know when I opened up my school in Durham, North Carolina, back in 1980, nobody wanted to lease any property because they thought we were doing devil worship because we did meditation. And so,
tell me about that one. I don't want to get into that. I did a seminar in Jacksonville, Florida, and somebody from up in that area got his students aside and said, when we go home, we will not talk about this. And I thought, what? And he about said that the devil's bringing that out and all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Never seen the guy again. They were saying that, they were in this era, they were calling martial arts New Age religion.
Yeah. And they told everybody that, and the Japanese are trying to get into your mind, and they're going to teach you, make you do their religion. Oh. Anyway, it's on the pass them up. Guess who introduced me to you?
Who's that?
Jeff Smith.
Us.
You know Jeff Smith?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think he's one of the, top fighters of all time. He's really good.
You were just saying a few moments ago, but, this is the way the Brotherhood of the Martial Arts, it wasn't about, because everyone, if you were hanging around, you were becoming someone and you had a skill set and you were part of it. And we were welcoming the toughness of this training and the opportunity to go out and test yourself. And I think that's, again, going back to the competitive side, of the martial arts. And then we began to make that turn to then start to want to understand. And I know that in your training with a lot of jiu-jitsu and tuite and a lot of the different things you've done, it seems, as I've looked at your journey, you reached a point of wanting more understanding. So let's talk about a little bit about now martial arts on the martial science or martial arts on the defensive side as an art of protection and skill sets.
Anything you want to do, if you ask the question, I'll hit the answer. I've gone in depth studying things. People told me, going up, this is that. I go, okay. But I found it hard to believe, because I had done boxing for 3.5 years and been hit. And they were telling me this will block this and this will block that. And I agreed with them. I'd go, okay, but I didn't believe them. And I went into research and kept asking questions. In 1972, I asked a man named Hohan Sokin, 83-year-old, one of the most respected masters in the entire world, out of Japan, China, and Okinawa, but he was out of Okinawa. I asked him questions. Well, he decided to give me the answers. If you read anything about him, he said he was in the martial arts. It's in the book Weaponless Warriors, by Black Belt Magazine. He said, I was doing the martial arts for 10 years, doing my kata, my weapons, my breaking, and doing everything I was to do. And after 10 years, my grandfather came and took me out to the barn and said, now it's time you learn real karate. And it doesn't say much more than that in the Weaponless Warriors, but I'm thinking, wait a minute. He's been to martial arts 10 years, and he still has something to learn. And his grandfather's going to teach him real karate. What's he been doing for 10 years? Well, that's when I found out. Hohan Sokin took me aside. Actually gave me a four-hour private lesson on pressure point and pressure point manipulation and how it fits in the forms.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, this was never taught because of World War II. You understand you are bombing us. You're bombing Japan. You're doing everything. Why would we teach you secrets? We wanted the money because we could earn food for our family by teaching the American soldiers karate, but we didn't really teach them karate. We taught them just sport, punchy, punchy, kicky, kicky. And he said the real art is hidden within the forms. And everything you think is a block became an excuse. What's this for, Sensei? Block. What's that for, Sensei? Block. What's that for? Two blocks. One, two. And none of those are blocks. They're all the proper angle and direction. And actually the power needed to manipulate pressure points in the human body. And that's what my seminars are about. I told people you would never use this block in a combat situation. The classical up block that you roll up and you're, first of all, you got the small bone of your arm in the air. If anybody has anything in their hand or it's just a lot stronger than you, the small bone breaks easier than the large bone. In fact, how much pressure it takes to break your small bone, it takes five times that to break the radial bone, the bigger bone, and if you block with both bones, it's almost impossible. You can't break a kid's both bones at the same time. Automobile accident maybe, train wreck, something like that, but you're not going to do it defending yourself. And when you roll that arm up, you stick, well, this is what he told me. I believed in all that at that point. He said, you've got the small bone in the air. If you know anything about acupuncture, that's your heart meridian. You're throwing that at your opponent. A pressure point is very dangerous to you. It's called heart point one, and it lies in the armpit. Why would you roll your arm up and expose heart point one to your opponent? Why would you have that crazy bone rolled towards your opponent? Everybody's banged their crazy, we call it the crazy bone, that ain't what it really is called, but everybody's banged that crazy bone and your whole arm goes numb. Why would you roll your arm up and aim that right at your opponent? He even punches hard and he catches you there. You lost the whole right side of your body or the left side of you blocked with it. And then he proceeded to show us a whole lot of things it was other than that, and boy, did it make sense. The same with the inside block and outside block. Somebody's throwing punches at you. You don't have time to do what they call an inside block and your fist out in front of your shoulder and come over here and stop. And then some of the forms have two of them, one, two. And you ask what they're for. This is blocking a kick. This is blocking a punch. That'll never happen in a combat situation. And it wasn't him, but then I went on to study with Seiyu Ayada, who mm-hmm. filled me in big time. And he said the football team don't practice anything they ain't going to use on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you practice doing blocks that you'll never use in your life? This is what these moves are for. And
that was one of my personal greatest experience, and the change of our teaching. And Mr. Wellendorf actually introduced Master Yada to our school back in the mid-70s, and we began to study and start to understand technique. And
right.
that was the biggest change in my training and moved me towards the adding of the Aikido side and the Jiu-Jitsu side, you know, in as a part of my training, because you can, you know, sparring is not fighting. And martial artists that, you know, you get out there, you might be a black belt, and you're going to get out there and try to spar with someone in a real self-defense situation, which you only have a few seconds to eliminate that situation, you know, you're gonna get hurt. And
right.
by having an understanding that how our body works and understanding the body and how the technique now fits and applies to that situation, you know, that changed back in that early mid-70s. That changed the way we were teaching kata. It changed our thinking about kata, and it also changed what we were teaching for self-defense.
Do you do forms?
Yes, sir.
You do?
Yes, sir.
And do you do some where you jump off the ground?
Yes, sir.
Like jump up and kick or jump up and double
mm-hmm.
kick?
Tento.
Your feet leave the floor?
Right.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a question. And it's good for you, if you don't know, to say, I don't know, but why do you leave the floor? You'd be more stable on the floor. This is the question
mm-hmm.
both of those instructors asked me. Why are you leaving? Why are you going off the floor? You're more stable and set to punch or whatever, but why'd you leave the floor? So I'm asking you, I'm going to educate you right now. Do you know why you're leaving the floor?
No, sir. Tell me.
Okay. You take on the polarity of your opponent if your feet are not on the floor and hit him. The polarity is the electrical control of his mind and his body, and it drops him. And I'm going to let you test it. People can hear this on the radio and go right to their dojo and test it. But when you leave the floor, you're the equivalent of lightning striking, coming down and striking an opponent.
What we call the Superman punch in MMA.
Three boxing matches, major boxing matches that have ended with, I think one of them was like two-ton Tony Galeno. He left the floor and knocked out this huge opponent, and they didn't know how. Well, I'm going to explain that right now. Anybody can go to their school or have an opponent. Have him hold his arm out towards you. He can make a fist or not a fist, but he can have a fist like he's going to hit you. And you hit his arm, not on a pressure point, because that'll work too. Not as, it'll work better if you do what I'm going to tell you now. But when you want to test it, when we get off here, and you're back at the school or working out with somebody, say, hold your arm out. Stand with both feet on the floor. Don't do anything. And tap his arm. And I mean, it only has to be a tap. A hit that a child would do. Give his arm a little chop. And then I want you to just jump up in the air, like Yahoo. Both feet have to pull off the floor. When they're off the floor, chop his arm. You'll numb his entire arm, and sometimes if you chop correctly or hard enough, he'll drop. Nothing more than that. Don't do anything more. Just chop his arm standing on the floor. Leave the ground and chop his arm. You'll deliver twice the power. Twice the power. You're the equivalent. It's compared in some of the books that I've seen on it out of China, etc., is compared to a lightning strike. In fact, some of the arts, I think, call it that, the strike of lightning. And that's when you leap the floor. So when you see Chinese people doing a form and they leap up off the floor and jump around and come down, and if you ask them, they won't explain it, but they go, oh, that lightning strike. That's all you need. And I want you to test it. And anybody listening to this, feel free to test it. It's going to work for everybody all the time. If it doesn't, you ain't chopping decently on both chops. You have to give it a nice little chop, but not to hurt him, just a chop. Hit his arm, which he probably thinks he can take. And he can. Oh, he can. But leap off the ground, he can't take it. Get the biggest, strongest dude you know. Chop his arm. Just lift, jump up straight up in the air. Pull both feet up like you want to hit your heels to your butt. Just so they're both off the floor and chop his arm. You'll see a result you won't believe. That's why forms have leave of the ground techniques. I always ask that. Nobody can answer that.
Okay.
And I got the answer.
And I have the answer. Now, in fact, I have your book right in front of me. I think I have pretty much all of your, well, not all of them, but the ones on pressure points in that. So I do follow you in a lot of the teachings that you do. So tell us a little bit about your books. What are the names of some of them, and where can people get them?
Amazon.com, Dillman.com. Dillman.com, just click on books, and up they come. You can read all about what's in them. And I think there's a place on there you can see a few pages from it. And or go to my DVDs and click on DVDs on my opening page, and it'll take you into the tapes I have. I have books. I have a book for teenagers, it's called. It's called Pressure Point Karate Made Easy, but it's for beginners and teenagers. I have a Little Jay Learns Karate book, which is actually for little kids, and it has a word game. And we've sold a ton of those. And then I have a book called, in fact, I gave 12,000 of those away, of those and the teen ones, out to the Navajo and Zuni Indian reservations for children that were doing classes and had no money to train, no money for this. And people volunteered to work with them on the martial arts, and I donated 12,000 of these books. And they loved it. They just loved it. But the next book is called Kyusho Jitsu, red cover, and it explains it all. Beginning to end. It's like my first lesson with Hohan Soken. Kyusho Jitsu, which is one-point fighting, is what it means. 1 second or 1 point. You hit me, I hit you. You should go down, I shouldn't. That's what that book's about. And you'll notice on the cover of that book, I'm off the ground. And when I hit the guy, he actually turned upside down. And if it wasn't for a catcher that was there, he would have had a very injured, if not broken, neck. But right on the cover of Kyosho Jitsu, I jumped up in the air and knocked out some black belt from Florida. And Len Gambler was his name. He was a Nisei Gojiru person that came out to be an uki for the book shoot. And the next book is Advanced Pressure Point Fighting, Oruku Kenpo. That sold out.
That's the copy I'm looking at now. That's the copy. I have a copy of that.
Oh, with a great cover.
Yes, sir.
Oh, hang on to that, because the only way you can buy that is off of eBay. That's out, gone. And people have actually paid several hundred dollars to get copies. Yeah, one just sold recently, one of my books, for $1,200. And the lady come on to Facebook, and she said, well, he paid more than I did, but I had to pay $700 to get my copy.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. I was joking. We had Larry Isaac and
any of that money, whoever. And then my last one's Advanced Pressure Point grappling, and that covers grappling. That teaches you how to grab and then where to strike. Or if you strike somebody and he's dizzy, where to grab. That's what that book's about. Grab, strike, or reverse it. And then I have one called Humane Pressure Point Self-Defense, which is aimed at policemen, security people, that type of thing. And I have also a DVD that teaches it live. And I actually had a policeman call me yesterday from Denver, Colorado, and he thanked me. He said, I've watched that police DVD at least 100 times. He said, because I'm out in the street and everybody's trying to get us, and I don't want anybody to get me, he said. Mm. He has my Humane DVD. And then I have an advanced one out now, which is actually that gray book rewritten with more in it. We call it that second book, the gray book on steroids. That's what we joke about.
Mm-hmm.
Same book, but we added steroids to it. Got a lot of muscle, meat. And I think that one covers the angle and direction and leave the floor. But if you leave the floor, it explains why. But you don't just leave the floor, because then if he hits you, you're going to dump down. You got to be in control of the situation. But a lot of katas, kata basai, everybody would say it means breaking through the fortress. Well, that's another thing we had wrong. Most of us had most of the names of these forms all wrong. We didn't know what they were, so Americans coming back just made up the names, and they, like Seiyu Iyata said, they weren't too good at making the names up. They named them breaking, crashing through the walls. You know, they named so the students would go, wow, I'm learning that form by crashing through walls. But if Basai has a leap in it, a leap.
Right.
And you land cross-legged.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I get you in a finger or a wrist lock and leave the floor, remember the theory I taught you a little while ago where if you hit the arm, then you leave the floor, hit the arm?
Right.
If I get you in a finger lock or a wrist lock and jump as in Basai, just leave the floor with both feet, I will break your wrist or your finger. I'm going to snap it big, and it takes no power. Less power from me, more pain on the person. And you can believe this story or not, but I have a policeman you can call up in Joliet named Dusty Seal. He's on my website. He has a karate school, but he brought a man from the Chicago football team, and he was the fullback. It's a couple years, brought him to the seminar, and he told me that won't work on me. This guy was 350 pounds, and he was with the Bears full-time, first-string player. And I said, yes, if I do that and leave the floor with your wrist like that, I said, your wrist is going to break. Not mine, he said, not mine. And I got him, and I did it real mild. And he said, oh, well, yeah, he said, but it didn't do this, that, and the other thing. He said, if my adrenaline's going, this is a true story, if my adrenaline's going and it's game day and you do that, it's not going to work, I'm going to hit you. I said, do you want to do game day? He said, yes. And he grabbed me. He didn't give me a chance. He grabbed me. And I grabbed his wrist. But he actually went, like an angry football player. And I went, too. I went, and I jumped off the floor. There were 180 people in the seminar that all heard his wrist break.
Wow.
It snapped like a 2x4. And he went down, dizzy from the nerves in the arm. Got up, tears in his eyes. He's standing there, and I knew his wrist was broke. He said, sir, I apologize. It will work. I have to go get my wrist fixed now.
Mm-hmm.
And they took him out to a hospital, and I never seen him again. And he ended his football career with that stupid move. He never played another day of football.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, they healed.
Sir, this has been, you know, this
they has healed
been,
his wrist. They can replace his wrist now.
Mm-hmm.
But he left there and he never went back. Well, they didn't take him back. They replaced him for game time. And once you're out and they got a new guy that they like in the job, you try getting back.
Right.
Well, that's what happened to him.
So what would you like to leave a message for, you know, today's martial artists, or what's the lesson that you've learned over your career that you would like to share with everyone?
Well, be polite, be humble. And by the way, the older I get, the more humble I'm becoming, but you be humble. And I've always taught my people never to talk about other martial artists. So many times I've seen schools want to fight each other and all kinds of things, and it's because of students going, our school is better than your school. No, they're not. Blah, blah, blah. And people would come up to me, and what about so-and-so? He's teaching this, that, and this. And I just say to them, honestly, which is true, if you stop and think, you don't know what they're teaching. I don't know what he's teaching in his school. I've never gone there. I don't go there. I have no idea. He might be good. He might not. You want to join my school? Watch my class. You think his is good? Go down, watch his class, and then you make up your mind. You know, who's the better teacher and who's going to... And my school was one of the largest in the country for years. I don't have one now. It's closed, and I sold the camp because I'm giving 75 a push. But it's better than the alternative, and I'm still here. And it's like I tell people, it's a privilege, as you know, denied to many.
Mm-hmm.
But the martial arts have kept me healthy. I've always told people, what do you like about the martial arts? I said, you know, more than the self-defense, it's kept me flexible and healthy. And I feel confident because I have a good self-protection no matter where I go with my family or whatever. And I said, but it gives you a whole different thought about your body and taking care of it. And eating properly. And, well, people go to me, well, you have a belly, you have a beer belly. Yeah, I do. I sit down at night, relax, and have one or two beers. But my diet is all as good as it can get for health things. And that's how it is. A lot of veggies, a lot of fish. And... I look at it for long life. I told people that for, 40, 50 years. There's a little funny story there. Bruce Lee told me, it's always fun to be able to drop Bruce Lee's name because nobody ever met him. Most of the people never met him. He's been gone 40-some years.
Mm-hmm.
But Bruce told me we were going to pose for a picture. And he said to me, you and George, you have to stop drinking beer. I said, why? He says, it's going to kill you. It's no good. That'll kill you. And I said, okay. I said, but my nationality, my family's German. On my father's side, my mother's side's Irish. I said, all they do is drink and fight. He laughed, you know. He said, well, stop the beer. And the funny thing was I had a beer in my hand at the time because it was a after party or something, and we were going to pose for a picture, and I put my hand behind his back with the beer in it so nobody would see a beer. He'd have had a fit. And there I am standing there with him smiling, and it looks like I have my hand on his hip, but I'm holding a beer behind his back. So then there you go. And I'm not pushing alcohol, but all the studies anymore, all of them, say one beer a day and you'll live longer. One alcohol, just one. Big men can have two. Women, one. One glass of wine, one beer, even just one shot of whiskey. Now, not sit there and get blasted, but the one-a-day theory. And I had that theory before they actually been testing the theory and running it out of several countries now. Several of the countries have run studies. And those that drink alcohol have a better chance of living longer, better health, and they're on less medications. So that's, I'm not pushing alcohol. I'm just telling you how it is.
Well,
anybody that doesn't drink and the studies say that, don't start drinking because you read those studies. But the studies are for real, and that's it. But I was never a drinker. I don't drink beer for lunch. I don't drink at supper. I don't drink when I was done my martial arts training at the school. We used to go next door to a local pub and sit and have a beer and a sandwich and shoot the bull because I was in the dojo all day.
Well, I thank you for being on our call today. And, again, you know, we really do appreciate you. We thank you for, again, having you in our book. And please let us know of anything that we can ever do for you. Again, the American Martial Arts, myself, Professor Gary Lee, and the martial artists around the country, you know, we celebrate and we honor you this month as a part of our Martial Arts History Month. Everyone,
When's Martial Arts History Month? December.
Well, yeah, we have created one. We have given people the opportunity to, from November the 21st to December the 21st. There's never been one done before, to our knowledge. We've searched. And So we wanted to connect this with the book because we're calling it a history book of...
When will this air?
Everyone, I want to thank you for being a part of our show. We've had on, you know, Grandmaster George Dillman, and this has been a really great show. A lot of information. This is the thing that we're trying to do with the American Martial Arts Alliance in conjunction with the Sport Karate Museum is preserving our history by going out, finding our masters and grandmasters, and getting information so we know how to train and how we know that we learn how to continue the process of learning in the martial arts. This is Grandmaster Jesse Bowen. I want you to have a great evening. Remember, keep tuning in for our show. Professor Gary Lee has some great guests coming up, and we're going to have a super fantastic show. And we're also going to be having book signings across the country. So our next show, we'll start announcing where we're going to be for our book signings and at tournaments and other seminars and workshops. So we have a lot of things planned for 2017. Remember, stay tuned in. And this is Grandmaster Jesse Bowen saying, have a blessed evening. And people are starting to listen to the show. So I figure that by next year, you know, we will actually, you know, people will recognize what we're actually doing.
Okay. Thank you. I got to go.
All right, sir. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.